Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
That indeed you are. And today we're going to talk with Donna Baker, who is founder of the Columbus Community Death Care.
Daycare. Maybe it's daycare. We don't know. We're going to find out.
And she is an Inelda, I'm going to assume you say it that way, Inelda, we'll talk about that in a bit, trained death doula, a home funeral guide, a death educator, and a member of the National Home Funeral Alliance. And she is a certified celebrant who has been officiating at weddings and end-of-life ceremonies, hopefully not at the same time, since 2005. So welcome, Donna. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Okay. Well, just to get us started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and essentially how you got involved in death?
Well, yeah. Aren't we all involved in death? I mean, it's life.
We are. You know?
There you go.
We are. Whether we want to face it or not, we are. Yeah. So I live here in Columbus, and I started my private practice about two and a half years ago. I trained through Inelda, like you mentioned. It's a nonprofit group basically started by a group of social workers and birth doulas who found that there was a real mirroring of death when we talk about birth. And these doulas transitioned from birth midwifery, birth care, into death doulaship, death care. And they started a nonprofit and started training folks who were interested in doing this work. So I went to my training, came back and thought, here I am, I'll be a death doula. And much to my surprise, nobody in Columbus, Ohio knew what I was talking about. So I spent a lot of time talking about what birth doulas are. And that's a great point of reference. Most of us know about home birth and, you know, following our own intuition and trusting our bodies when it comes to birthing at home. And that's really what I'm promoting with death work as a doula and in general, just as a community death care advocate, that these are things we've been doing forever and let's get back to them. So I spend a lot of time, more time than I imagined, educating, giving presentations and offering consultations and a little bit of time doing doula work, not as much as I'd like, but people are starting to catch on and seeing the beauty and having an assistant at the end of life. So, you know, I'm maybe once a month I'm hired to work with a family and teach them how to be with their dying person.
Well, I wonder though, what happened in your life or what crossed your path that made you find this a place you wanted to go to?
Yeah, so, you know, I think like everyone in this work, a significant loss is usually what brings us here. But you know, for me, maybe even more than that, I grew up in Northern Ohio and farm country, and I just had a real sense of commune with nature and with life and death since I was a kid. My sister and I would spend a lot of time building elaborate coffins for our hamsters and our kittens and all of our farm friends, burying them in the back of our yard and creating elaborate ceremonies to see them off. And just, you know, growing up in that environment of understanding animals as food, really, you know, or being around, surrounded by farms. I just became interested in death and looking for the spiritual part of death, looking for some meaning behind the loss that came with losing animals and pets in particular. And so it's kind of, I guess it's always been there for me. It's been an interest, but as I got older, I gave birth to both of my daughters at home in 2002 and 2005. And, you know, that's just the kind of experience that will shake your whole life. As soon as my babies were handed to me, I just thought, okay, if we can do this at home, if we can birth, if we can bring life in onto the planet here, you know, in our own beds, surrounded by our family and our dogs and our good music, and sit down to have a, you know, a big feast afterward, then we should certainly be able to die this way. And I never stopped thinking about it. I started reading about natural burial grounds and green burials and home funerals. And I never stopped hoping that that might be something I could eventually be an advocate for. And it wasn't until about 5 years ago, I started volunteering with hospice and just wanting a little bit more, wanting to be a little closer to the dying person and their family and serve them in ways that felt more spiritually sound, offer a little more, a little more soul to the process than I was finding in hospice care, which was fairly medicalized and sort of rote.
Well, when did our society sort of make death clinical? Because I think we have a sense, at least historically, that death was kind of a community thing. You know, people were used to it. It happened right amongst them, and they all participated in the process. And now suddenly it's become, as you mentioned, part of the medical model. I mean, when did that happen, and what problems does that create in the process?
Yeah, you got it. I mean, you know, in the early 1900s, we started to really see birth and death as, medical events. They were no longer social or spiritual events. Really, the technological demands of what we perceived as the technological demands of birth and death moved us from home and from our communities into hospitals. And, you know, it was around the time that we started to think, we started to believe what we were being told, which is that we really couldn't handle the process of dying. And once a person was dead, you know, we definitely didn't want to handle their bodies, that work was left for experts, you know, specialists like morticians and funeral directors. And so we bought into the idea that there were people who could provide that service for us. So our dead were quickly taken from us, and we were okay-ish with that. You know, we went along for quite a while just thinking that this was work for someone else, not for us. But you know, obviously this is not a new idea. What I'm proposing is not my idea, and it's not a new idea. It's an ancient practice. We took care of each other in this way. Forever, really, you know, we gathered around and held our dying person. And, when they transitioned, we washed their bodies and, celebrated their life. And we'd take a shovel and go out and dig a hole and lower the body into the ground and throw the dirt back on top. This work is in our bones.
Yeah, you know, I think about that too, because I find it fascinating about the spiritual process of death. And to me, it seems like it might, in some cases, be the most important part of that person's life and how they die and how it all ends. And how amazing it would have been, like when my father died, my mom said, I can't do anything. I can't touch him. I can't, because I kept asking her to help him die because he was already gone. And so this became a big deal because she couldn't believe that I would, you know, lean in, I'll just put it that way, to him and what was happening. And she just thought that was the most horrific thing and was horrified by it. But I think we are changing as a culture and asking in some cases for these experiences, because COVID has shown us the really horribleness of having to look through a window at somebody when they're sick or dying or whatever, versus if we could have been there to hold their hand. So we want a richer experience with death, for some of us anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really see a cultural desire to slow down and stay close to our dying and care for our dead. And, you know, it's, I had my first home funeral a couple weeks ago, and it's something I've been reading about and focusing on and training to do, but nothing can prepare you for when it actually happens and you get to see firsthand the kind of soul and beauty that comes with keeping a body in a home, for 8, 10, 12 hours, caring for that body, allowing that family to have time to be with the body, to start to separate from the person. You know, when you're, I'm sure you have this understanding, given your experience with your father, but there's a real healing that begins when you can spend time with the body of a person after the spirit has left, and you recognize that that's no longer your person. And that separation, the time, the longer the time you can have for that separation, the more healing can take place. You know, there's the families that I work with, I always ask them if they want to participate in after death body care. And most of them will say no, in theory, while their person is still alive and we're trying to make plans. But after the person has passed, almost everyone does end up participating. And it's after all, you know, start brushing a person's a body, brushing the hair of a deceased person's body, or anointing that person's hands and arms and legs with oil. And I'll ask the family for consent, and I'll ask them if they like to participate. And they do. They lean right into it, and they'll say things like, I really wanted to do this, but I had no idea how to do this, or I felt weird asking if I could do this. But it's very healing. And, you know, that kind of attention to our dying person, to the body of our loved one, death becomes less frightening, less traumatic when you have that experience. And if you're ever fortunate enough to be with a body in that way, I always tell people it will change your life. It will change your whole view of life, and obviously change your view of death.
Okay, well, I'm going to interrupt here for just a second to let people know that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. Reminding you again, it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
And that's kind of an appropriate line in that we are speaking with Donna Baker, who is the founder of the Columbus Community Death Care. And we were just talking here, Donna, about the process that you go through in helping people deal with the realities and the process of death. And I was wondering if maybe you could walk us through just quickly. Somebody comes to you, I'm assuming that someone close to them or maybe themselves are in the process of dying, and they, you know, logically say, I want to go and get some help from somebody who understands this process. Is that a fairly good reading of it? And if so, yeah. What do you do? How do you go through this? What happens?
Yeah, well, folks come to me at all different stages of the dying. Sometimes I'll get phone calls from people who will say, my mother has stage 4 cancer, and we've just decided that her quality of life, or she's decided that her quality of life isn't where she would like it to be, and we've decided along with her to stop her treatment. Can you help us to figure out how the next, you know, few weeks or months will go? Some folks will call and say, my father's on a ventilator, it's COVID, and we're taking him off the ventilator tomorrow afternoon. And we're just looking for some information about how that might look. what that process will look like. Will it be painful? Will it be, how long will it last? Is there enough time for us to take him home so he can die at home like he wanted? Or is there enough time to move him to a private room? So many questions. And, you know, what I always find interesting is that I would hope these are the kinds of questions that people could ask their healthcare providers. But what I find is that oftentimes we don't really get the kind of answers that we need from Western medicine. You know, Western medicine is in the business of fixing problems and fixing people. And it sometimes that is that sort of over-medicalized death keeps us from dying and keeps us from, I always say, the sooner that we can get on with the dying, the better that we are. And I know that sounds a little weird to people who don't have a sort of a death positive view, but you know, we're really in a society where we spend all of our time and energy and unfortunately a lot of money working to keep people alive, even past the point when a lot of us would like to be alive. So when we go to our practitioners to ask for the kinds of things that people ask me, the answers that people get aren't often that helpful. And what I find is that people really want the truth. You know, knowledge is power. And if you can understand the physiology of death and dying, then you can really come to terms with it more quickly, and you can have better information about how to be with the dying person. So a lot of the consultations that I end up giving to folks are things like that, just practical questions about death and dying.
Well, do the medical folks usually look at this like death is losing the game, and do they look at you as kind of being on the enemy's side, or are they supportive of you coming in and helping?
You know, really supportive. To answer your first question, I think, yeah, I even the language that we use, right? Like we're cancer warriors, or we're fighting cancer, and all of that language leads us to believe, you know, somewhere that if we're fighting and we die, then we've lost. And so, yeah, I do think that physicians are trained to fight and to solve problems and not to give up. But I've had so many amazing experiences. My most recent was in the emergency department at Ohio State with a woman who was dying, and her partner hired me to help to come in and help them through their last few days. And I was working with the emergency doctors and her oncologist in particular. And when I explained my role, he was completely supportive and really just sort of open and inquisitive. And it was just one of many experiences I've had with folks in really fairly traumatic situations where doctors will just say, yeah, you know this, I'm glad you're here. Like I haven't been trained to talk about it this way. And this is really better off in the hands of an end of life specialist now instead of a medical specialist.
And that, I think that's where, you know, we have to sort of back up, because we, as our culture doesn't have good language skills and practice around talking about these issues, because we've been handing them off to the quote unquote professionals. And that's just become really crazy. So we lack language, we lack the practice. And then I think it is true that doctors aren't trained. They don't have, for the most part, the bedside manner. They don't have the language either. So they're happy to pass it off on to other people, because they'll couch everything, you know, in that sort of sense of, if we can't cut it out or we can't mask it, we got to just keep fighting. Anyway, so I wanted to ask you, it strikes me and maybe this isn't a question, but just a comment to talk about, is that what really needs to happen is we need to have some kind of official legitimacy around having death doula as part of that dying process with doctors, with medical people, because who would get married without an officiant? So why aren't we having officiants with our deaths?
For sure. And, you know, in other countries, in New Zealand, doulas are in all of the hospitals and hospices. Doulas have their own, you know, nonprofit organizations where you can just go to hire a doula. On the West Coast, San Francisco and LA, doulas are being employed in hospices and hospitals. And, you know, this is also work that most of the medical professionals that I talk to and work with, this isn't their work. This isn't the work they want. I mean, no oncologist has 8 hours to spend holding the hand of a person who's dying of pancreatic cancer, right?
Yes, they do, but they don't want to.
Right. Well, it's not in their pay.
It's not their priority, not their pay grade.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, this is really, you know, that's why I love talking about community death care, because I feel like there are so many roles for all of us in taking care of our dead and dying. And it's not one or the other. It's a collaboration. And doulas, and really any death worker, and I talk about doulas a lot because that's really one of my main focuses. But you know, being a death care worker doesn't require you to have any specific training. We go by so many different names because this isn't there's no credential, there's no governing board. You can call yourself what you like. And if you're willing to step in there and teach people how to be with their dying person, teach people how to care for and bury their dead, you know, there's definitely a need and an interest in that. And you don't have you don't need to be a professional. You know, we're not taking the place of an industry that's already,
there's nothing already there. So you're filling a void. Well, the other thing is that there's also a void from the very beginning of this, whether a person's dying or not, we owe it to our loved ones to create a plan. So they know what we need and want, and also so it makes it easier for them, or it's smoother, I'll put it that way. And so don't you assist with that? You can come in long before this, like maybe we're planning our will or something, and you can answer a lot of those hard questions or help create words so people can talk about it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, having your advanced directives is a term that people are finally becoming familiar with, and having your advanced directives finalized is basically a document that tells your family how you'd like to be cared for when you can no longer speak for yourself, having a healthcare power of attorney. And those sorts of plans are just an incredible gift to your family, because, you know, we all know this situation where someone dies and there's a family just left in the wake of that trauma, you know, stepchildren who are arguing about whether mom should be buried next to the stepfather or the birth father, you know, all kinds of family dynamics. In the queer community, there are all sorts of issues around gender identity and whether a person can be would be honored as the gender that they chose to be, or the gender that they were born with. And, you know, until you have this stuff, until you've told people how you feel and what you want, and you have these documents notarized and made into legal documents, it's up for grabs once you're gone, and it causes families a lot of pain. Having these things done is the best gift that I can think of to give to your family after you've left.
Well, you're not seeing Annie or I, but we're getting to an age where death seems to be a lot more frequent. You know, knowing a lot of people dealing with it a lot more often. And I know Annie often will tell me, if I wake up from an accident in a hospital, I'm going to come back and haunt you, and, you know, all of these kind of things. So it's interesting that I know people who are not necessarily afraid of death or dying, but they're afraid of dying badly.
In the medical model, well, that's what I'm afraid
yeah,
of.
Yeah, and I guess I would be curious to find out from you, what would you consider a really good death? You know, what would be a good way to die in your experience and in your opinion?
Well, you know, to me, a good death is a death that has had some thought behind it, a death that occurs after families have had a chance to talk about what it means to die, sort of a conscious, I refer to it as conscious dying, talking about how the person feels about death, whether death is, you know, a natural part of the life cycle, what their religious beliefs are, and just having opportunities while we're alive and healthy to really share our views on all of those things. And like Annie said earlier, having the vocabulary to really talk about it in a way that you can start to wrap your head around it. You know, it's also hard to talk about what a good death is lately, just politically. And there's a, you know, there's a huge activist angle to this, to community death work, because we're all not so fortunate to have our good death. People of color in communities where there's a lot of violence, you know, it's, I'm starting to see it as a luxury to be given a life limiting diagnosis, so that you have time to say goodbye. You have time to check the things that you want off your bucket list. Expected death is starting to feel like a privilege to me after witnessing so many deaths. Unexpected death and violence is a whole nother thing. And so, to me, a good death is just a death that we've explored. We've explored our mortality before we get there, and we've shared with our family what we want, so we can have the quickest beginning to the earliest grieving and the quickest path to healing possible.
Okay, well, Donna, I want to thank you. We've been speaking with Donna Baker, who is the founder of the Columbus Community Death Care. And you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our producer, Adam Rich, and we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and be good about planning your death.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Blossom in the night, know the sky's dancing.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.